So this is Erica Milam, and I am interviewing Evelyn Howell for the Women in Science Oral History Project at the University of Wisconsin. Today's date is December 1st, 2003. So, Evelyn.
Great. Yes, this is Evelyn.
When and where were you born?
Well, I was born on February 28th, 1947 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And I understand it was a snowy day, although I don't remember, as you might imagine. Yeah, so that's where I began.
Okay. Uh-huh. And tell me a little bit about your childhood and your early years of schooling.
Okay, well, I had a very pleasant, happy childhood, I would say, living actually in a suburb of Milwaukee called Shorewood, about three blocks from Lake Michigan. And I was pretty much an urban person in those days, and my earliest recollections of things that really influenced me were, embarrassingly, baseball, because I became a big fan of the Milwaukee Braves, who were the best thing to hit Milwaukee in that era, I guess, that Milwaukee had ever known, and I got totally hooked on baseball. And my hero was Del Crandall, who was the catcher of the Braves. So in my early years, I wanted to be a baseball player, realizing, of course, never happened. And in school, I went to a public grade school called Atwater Elementary School, which was a wonderful place with small classes, about 20 kids in a class. And I was a very good student. I really enjoyed school, and I liked all aspects of it, every subject particularly. And my most memorable event from grade school is an embarrassing one, but it happened in my sixth year. This grade school then went from kindergarten through sixth grade. Mm-hmm. And when you got to be a sixth grader, you got to do some things around the school, one of which was to run the films that dealt with human sexuality, because we had basically sex education at that time. And the sexes were separate, so the girls were in one room, the boys in another, and I was entrusted to run the film for the girls, and discovered afterwards that I had the volume on so long that all the boys who were in another place happened to hear it. So I was all embarrassed, thinking that this mysteries of human women's sexuality was being broadcast to the boys, in addition to all the girls. So that was my most embarrassing remembrance from grade school. But I enjoyed grade school quite a lot. And the only sad thing or bad thing that happened to me was I have always had asthma. And as a result, I got kind of segregated from some of the kids during recess times, had to stay inside, and it kind of made me feel like an outsider. And I also was pretty shy, always very worried about speaking up in class, and that kind of has carried on a thread, which maybe we'll get to later, throughout my college years and also into grad school.
Yeah.
And then I went on to, because I was shy, to a private high school, which had much smaller classes. It was called Milwaukee University School, which began as the German-English Academy way back in the middle 1800s, and which I subsequently discovered was the basis for the natural history collection at the Milwaukee Public Museum, because the students back then in the 1850s collected things all over Milwaukee area and created an herbarium and specimens that were donated to the public museum. But in any event, I went to the very well-respected academically high school which my dad had attended. And I was put there primarily on the advice of a physician who said that I was so shy, maybe it would be a good idea to go to a place with small classes. So I did. And in high school, again, I was interested in all kinds of subjects, including science, and was, again, a fairly good student. We had, at that time, a junior high and high school in the same building. So 7th and 8th grade was junior high, and high school was 9 through 12. And the one thing that is most memorable to me in my high school was when I was a junior, the high school decided to merge with two other private institutions in the Milwaukee area, one of which was a women-only or girl-only school and the other a boy-only school. And the merger was to take place in my senior year, and what was going to happen is the co-ed school I went to was broken up, and the girls would go to the former girls' school and the boys would go to the former boys' school. And the difficulty there was that, in my opinion, all the good teachers went to the boys' campus and all the weaker teachers went to the girls' campus. Plus, for me to continue on in advanced math, which I was most interested in at that time, I had to go to the boys' campus to take a math class. And the campuses were fairly far apart, too. They were in different parts of the greater Milwaukee area. So myself and another girl were bused to the boys' campus, and we started each day at the boys' campus with all these other boys in an assembly. And it was very uncomfortable, to be honest. And it was fine in terms of the class I did fine with, but it was a very uncomfortable thing, especially at that age, to be suddenly separated again, which is kind of the thread I think many women have felt. Mm-hmm. And it took a little bit of bravery to stand up to that, because we were set aside. And then in the girls' campuses where I would take physics, and the course there was actually not the strength that it was at the boys' campus. That was a dilemma. And in those days, which would have been in the 60s, they were just beginning to experiment with having people take calculus in high school. And so that was the class that I took at the boys' campus, because I had been prepared by doubling up on math all the way through the rest of the curriculum. So that was the big thing I remember and still resent to this day. And now, of course, the school is back to being co-ed, and life is different for those kids, but it was really awkward, and it was also awkward to have a change in your senior year, because you'd been looking forward to being the leaders all along, and then it didn't happen the same way. So for whatever use that is for this project, it did point out to me really a difference in education of men and women very directly and distinctly, which kind of stayed with me.
Did you have any role models? So, we were talking about your early childhood schooling stuff, and it's clear that you were very interested in science by the time that you graduated. So when did you first become interested in science?
Well, I would say the first two things, there were two things that really got me interested. One of them was the Sputnik event that happened, as you may remember, in the middle 50s, something like that, and that got a lot of the educators really interested in making sure kids learned science. So because of that, there was an emphasis placed on math in particular in my grade school and also later on in high school. And people were really encouraged to be intrigued by those things. My parents were never that interested in science. They were more English majors, history majors, political science kinds of folks, economics. And so it was a little bit of an anomaly that happened, but I think a lot of it had to do with the times and the concern over science education with kids. And then I also got really interested in math. It just really intrigued me, the beauty of it and the elegance of the solutions, and it came easily to me. So I kind of fell right into that idea that math was fun and that I could do it. And my parents certainly encouraged me to follow whatever interests I had. But I was not particularly interested in biology at that point. Although I always loved gardens and flowers and things, and animals, of course, as most kids did. But not really that intrigued about the study of biology until I got into college, actually. But we'll get to that maybe a little bit later.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's, I think I was a product of the Sputnik revolution.
And so you found that, it sounds like very much at the school before it split, that they did a good job of encouraging you, at least, and possibly other girls as well in math and science, so it wasn't just boys.
No, definitely. In fact, we were very encouraged and pushed to take advanced classes and talked quite a bit about careers in science to us. But when the split happened, that really was a different issue, different climate, and suddenly being thrust with the girls' school where that was not emphasized at all. And of course, it was my perception at the time, and may not even have been true, but my perception that the teachers that I felt were the best and that I had been looking forward to, in some cases, taking classes from, went to the boys' campus, and others went to the girls' campus.
So did you have any particular role models at this point?
Well, in high school, there were a couple of teachers that influenced me, although they were not necessarily science teachers. One of them was a history teacher who also taught English. And what I found most intriguing were the way she would give out assignments. And a couple that I remember to this day was one assignment where we were to pick a year in history, and the year I picked was 1848, I don't know why, where we were supposed to look up to see everything that was happening in that year from all fields of interest and write mm-hmm. a paper on it. So this meant what were the plays that were being produced, what were the artists who were painting or whatever, mm-hmm. what was the issues in the news of that times, what were the big social upheavals, all of the things like that. And it was so intriguing to me because it was cross-disciplinary, and it was yeah. fun to see how things were being debated. And the library in the school supported this project. Obviously, they had made sure that was the case. And so you could go back and look at women's goatees, ladies' books type things. I don't even know if that was published then, but this is the equivalent, mm-hmm. as well as books that had been written at that time and other things. And I loved it because it was so interesting to me in all levels. And this particular faculty member would ask questions like that quite a lot, those mm-hmm. kind of interpretive questions. And then at an earlier stage, an English teacher had us look up myths, classical mythology. This would be in junior high. And we had to do a paper on all the things in modern America that were based on the myths of the Greeks and Romans. So
yeah.
we did everything from cut out advertisements for mobile oil and show Pegasus and explain where Pegasus came from to other allusions in both pop, in the literature and the popular press. And it was a great assignment again because it got me thinking about all kinds of different interrelationships. And I think those were the two people that really inspired me because of that. Excuse me. Okay, and in fact, one of these was a woman and the other man. So okay. it wasn't just one gender. And yeah. it was about equally balanced at the original school. Mm-hmm. And actually at the school I went to, it was fairly well balanced, men and women.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then you decided to go to Carleton.
Yes, and that's for a couple of reasons. Mm-hmm. My parents both went there, so I knew about it. Okay. And the counselors at school thought it would be a good match for me because it was a mm-hmm. small school, again, given my shyness background.
Right.
And it was also well regarded academically. And I also wanted to not be anxious my whole senior year worrying about what school I would be admitted to. So this was one of the first places that would allow early admission. So as soon as I could, I applied, and it was the only school I applied to, and
wow.
naively. And luckily for me, I guess, or maybe not, I don't know. Anyway, I got in. So I knew I was going there right from the beginning of my senior year. So it made senior year more relaxing in terms yeah. of worrying about schools. And again, it was a choice. I didn't do a whole lot of digging around looking for places the way mm-hmm. I see a lot of people do today. But I took the advice of the counselors, essentially, in the high school who said, and in this case it was the first high school because I was doing this in my junior right. year. They said that they thought it would be a good match, and they recommended a couple of other places too.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the one I settled on, partly, I'm sure, because my parents had gone there and I felt it wasn't that far away, and
yeah.
my shyness routine continuing, I thought it would be a good place for me.
Yeah.
So I did.
Mm-hmm. And so at Carleton was where mm-hmm. you became interested in biology.
That's right, yes. I went to Carleton to begin with as a math major, and
right.
Found math still to be quite interesting and not all that, it wasn't that scary to me. In other words, it was at least the level I continued, it was came easily to me. But about the second, this was, Carleton, let me back up, was on a trimester schedule, which yeah. meant there were three terms during the year, essentially. And I had started school in the summer, which they offered to a few people, saying, if we've selected you to come during the summer term, take some courses, get a jump on the school, and then you can take a semester off down the road or do something else that
yeah.
way. So I did. I went in the summer, and I took math again and an economics course to get those things out of the way. And was wonderful time, by the way. I really recommend summer before college to be a great way for me to get used to the place. I had a wonderful roommate, and
yeah.
It was helpful for me to kind of ease into the college experience. And I, by the time fall came, I had some confidence that I was able to do the material, because as part of my personality, I was always very worried that I was not going to understand things, that I was not going to get it, that I was stupid, you know, even though I know I'm not now.
Yeah.
But at that time, I didn't feel confident, so it was a good way to ease my anxiety. But anyway, I came as a math major, but in about the second term of the normal year, so it would have been what they would have called the winter term, I began talking to folks about what could you do with a math major, and began to realize that the options weren't all that attractive to me. They would talk about being a high school teacher, and although I have been attracted to teaching for a long time, I thought I wasn't sure I wanted to do it at the high school level. And they talked about being in the defense industry, and I thought, I'm not so keen on that. And so then I switched to physics, and took several courses in physics, and that was more challenging for me. It wasn't as intuitive to me as math was for some reason. I don't know whether it's because I didn't spend my childhood tinkering with mechanical things or whatever, but it just, I really had to think through problems that other people just would say, well, automatically, I know that the elevator works this way. So it was eye-opening for me from that standpoint. But I also had a conversation with a physics teacher, professor, who basically said, if you're going to go into physics, you're going to become a nuclear engineer. That's what's the hot topic now. And I thought that was just not for me at all. That was worse than the defense industry, given what I thought about the nuclear threat. And backing up a little bit, one of the fears in many of the childhoods of people growing up in my era was the nuclear war. And this was a little bit before the Cuban Missile Crisis and during my junior high and high school in the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I would have nightmares about horrible things happening and for nuclear warfare. So that was like a horrible red flag to me to think that that was what I'd have to do. And I had been taking chemistry and also a biology class, and in the third semester of my freshman year, I took a biology class, which was like typical intro to biology. And changed my major and said, okay, I'm going to be pre-med, because I got very intrigued with biology. And I really enjoyed that class and a couple of others I began to take in the next few years and stayed on as a pre-med major. And at Carleton, if you were pre-med, you were encouraged to not just take biology, but a lot of other things, because it's a liberal arts school. So I took history and I took English and a lot of things like that, which I think made my life a lot more fun than if I was just a math or a chemist that took the sciences. But what happened in my junior year was I took an ecology class, and that class changed my whole life. Actually, it was my senior year. Sorry, it was my senior year, because I had even been going through preparation to take the MedCats and all the things that move on to medicine. But I took an ecology class, and it changed everything for me. And there were two, I think, reasons for it, one of which is we were reading books in conjunction with the ecology class, including things like Silent Spring, and which is Rachel Carson's famous book. And I read that book, and it really opened my eyes, because she talks about the DDT spraying for Dutch elm disease in the book. And as a kid living in the city, in the suburbs of Milwaukee, I would be out playing in the planes came by and dumped DDT on the elm trees to spray the bark beetles, and I suffered the effects of that DDT, because having asthma, of course, it would trigger an asthma attack. And I really began to be outraged that I was exposed to that, given what Rachel Carson was talking about in Silent Spring. So it turned me into this whole new direction of worrying about environmental issues and environmental effects. And we also read several other books that were along the same lines, but one of them was something called Man's Role in Changing the Face of the Earth, which was actually written by a series of geographers as much as by biologists, talking about how people have impacted the environment. And all of that began to get me really interested in that whole area of ecology. And I also got intrigued by some of the explanations for ecological interactions that were then current, and got to think about them as mathematically, getting back to my math interests. So I got very intrigued by that and started to just forget all of the pre-med, I'm going to become an ecologist, and talk to the professor there, Professor Jensen, and he told me that the best place for ecology at that time was probably Wisconsin. And I think that was probably because of his bias more than anything else. So again, very naively, I applied to UW-Madison for graduate school in ecology. And I say naively because that was the only place I applied to again,
right.
Which to me blows my mind these days.
Yeah.
And I applied to the botany department and the zoology department, and they both accepted me, but the botany department offered me a teaching assistantship. And that's how I became a member of the botany department.
Yeah.
And I had taken several plant classes in Madison from Professor Muir, who was a graduate of the, I think, plant pathology department here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had him to talk to, too, in terms of the UW. And he set me at ease with the botany department. But I feel like my history has been all this series of serendipitous events, reading certain books, and naively applying to one place, getting accepted. And I think the botany department was probably strapped for teaching assistants. And my record in school was good in terms of the classes I took. And I had taken a wide variety of classes, so that I was fairly well versed in not just ecology, but various other forms of biology, which help if you're a TA.
Yeah.
And so if they had really known me, I don't think they would have asked me to be a TA because I was still so darn shy. In college, when I was first there as a freshman, you know, you have to go see your advisor. And in a liberal arts school, they wouldn't know when you're a freshman what you're majoring in, so you're assigned just kind of randomly to an advisor. And I was assigned to the school band director, essentially. And I was so petrified to go see him that I made my roommate go with me and show what a dork I was. I was just scared to death to go see this person who... I didn't know who he was. I didn't know what to expect. And it was awful for me.
Yeah.
And when I came to Madison, I wasn't assigned an advisor either. I was just admitted to both departments and given a teaching assistantship. So then they randomly assigned me an advisor, which turned out to be a physiologist by the name of Skoog, who... was kind of a curmudgeon, and of course I knew nothing about him, and I had no particular interest in plant physiology, so it was not a very good match, and it kind of reinforced my worry, my being afraid worry. But I ultimately gravitated toward Ed Beals, who was then in the botany and zoology department, and began talking with him a little bit about things. But then Professor Cottom, Grant Cottom, had money to offer me to become not a teaching assistant, but a research assistant. This would have been my second or third year. And so I just said, okay, I'll go with him. So it was not, again, it was a serendipitous choice. It wasn't even necessarily thinking it through and looking to see who the different faculty were and who I would match with. It was more, I felt like a random ping pong.
Interesting.
It was. So pretty stupid of me, or naive of me anyway.
Yeah. Were there any female professors at Carleton or here?
Carleton, there were several female women professors. Not all. There was one in biology, and hers was kind of a sad tale in that she became a professor because she couldn't get the corn that she was going to do her PhD dissertation on to grow. And I know, to this day, I'm not sure whether it was the problem of the hybrid or problem of the weather or whatever. But so she was essentially an ABD, an all but dissertator, who then came to teach at Carleton. And that was kind of the tail attached to her. And the other faculty in the biology department were men.
Okay.
And there were several other women professors at Carleton, one who had been there for many, many years in economics. She was probably in her 70s at the time that I was there. And there were several in the English department. But most of the faculty that I took courses from were men.
Okay. And then there
were no women in the botany department. And in fact, there had been a woman many years before I was attached to the department. And the scuttlebutt was that the faculty would never have another woman professor because this professor got her way by crying. And we can't have that, said the men in the department.
Right.
So when I arrived there, especially in not in the whole department, but certainly not in the ecology department, there were no women faculty. And so I worked with men, both taking courses and also teaching under them and so on.
Yeah.
In the grad school student ranks, there were, I'm guessing, maybe 30% women. So we were beginning to infiltrate.
Yeah.
Even then.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so then at that time, did you think that you wanted, I mean, what were your career plans?
Right. You ask my naive self here what my career plans were. Well, the funny thing is when I went to grad school, I think the main reason for going was not a career reason. It was because I was so intrigued by the study of ecology. So mm-hmm. I was really living in an ivory tower, and I wasn't thinking about 10 years down the road, 15 years down the road. Yeah. I was just thinking for the next 5 years I can learn as much as I can, and I'm going to be paid because I'm a TA, so I don't have to worry about supporting myself. Mm-hmm. And the money at that point was generous enough. I had no problem living on it at mm-hmm. all. And I really was looking mostly just because it was such an interesting field, and I was just thrilled to death and excited over it. Yeah. And about the time I was getting toward the end of my PhD, I had to begin to think seriously about what am I going to do? Because they're not going to pay me to be a student forever, is finally dawning in my head. And I then thought about it, and I really wanted to be a teacher, because I found that being a TA just caused me to blossom. Mm-hmm. It helped me overcome some of my shyness, and I really began to be interested in the process of learning and teaching what I know and seeing other people learn with me, because mm-hmm. they were teaching me as much as I was teaching them, is what the old line is, and it was really true. And I loved being a teaching assistant, and I the first assignment I had, maybe we can back up to that
a little bit,
was teaching in 151, 152, which at that time was on the books, and it was taught jointly by the botany and the zoology department. And there was one botany professor, Professor Whittingham, and a zoology professor, Professor Neese, who were in charge of the course. Mm-hmm. And the theory was that it is different from the other intro courses because it combined plants and animals in one seamless whole, so that in other intro courses you'd take zoology and you'd learn about the cell. If you took the botany course, you'd learn about the cell, but it would mm-hmm. be the animal cell and the plant cell in both cases. But in this class, they were supposed to be talking about the cell, and at the same time you'd learn about plant and animal cells and compare them, essentially. And that was one of the nice things about the course. But the other fun thing was the labs were run entirely by the TAs. There was no lab manual that was recommended by the faculty, and in fact, none that was required. And so you were basically told, okay, here's your section. These are the topics we're covering in lecture. Have fun.
Wow.
And for the first year TA, that was mind-boggling. But fortunately, there were some other TAs who had been teaching the course for a while, and they had suggested exercises that had been used.
Yeah.
And so I spent my first year in that class basically being mentored by a senior grad student mm-hmm. who helped me through how to do this. And by the time I'd been there for several months, I was making up my own exercises and beginning to have a lot of fun, because it was so creative. We could do whatever we wanted to. Nobody was monitoring it. Didn't matter if all the sections did something different, as long as the main topic was of the day was covered. So mm-hmm. we did everything from dissecting animals to field trips in the ecology section. And really got me able to use all the background I had, plus really begin to think about it. And I really enjoyed, I was a TA for several years and really enjoyed it, and took mm-hmm. the research assistant just because it got me further along in terms of a topic, a research topic,
right.
and so on. But then I began to think about what should I do for my future. So my plan, when I had about a year to go on my dissertation, was to begin to think about being a faculty member in a liberal arts school like Carleton, mm-hmm. because that's where teaching was primary, and I thought I would really enjoy being in small classes and being able to explore and do things like the high school teacher had done so many years ago.
Yeah,
take a topic that really integrated things. And so I had been thinking along those lines, but not terribly seriously in terms of sending a resume out or doing things of that sort. And one of the projects I had worked on in my master's and PhD program, actually my PhD more than the master's, was a project funded by the federal government through the states, where we were supposed to be identifying critical resources that need to be protected. Mm-hmm. And my job was to look at the natural systems resources and try to figure out how you would identify those that were most crucial to the survival of the planet, essentially. Part of the team I worked on was a member of the landscape architecture department named Ben Neiman, who was looking at other things, not at the plants. And so I didn't work very closely with him, but I had met him. And Ben, in the fall of the last year of my PhD program, started to talk to me about a possible one-year position in landscape architecture, teaching ecology to landscape architects. So he was out recruiting a likely ecologist who would come cheap and be there for a year and do this.
Yeah.
And I thought about it and eventually applied for that position, figuring it would buy me another year to really look seriously for a situation. And I interviewed. We were talking about my crazy career path and
yes.
the fact that I had thought I would take a one-year position in landscape architecture at the end of my PhD life in order to buy me some time to find another place to be permanently. And when the job position was offered, it was offered as a tenure-track position. Apparently, in my way I look at it now, they needed women at that time. And here was a likely woman who they could offer a position to. So I thought about that, but I accepted it, figuring I could always stay the year and then leave. Who
yeah.
knows? And so I took the position in landscape architecture, knowing very little about the whole department or what I was going to get into. But I was very intrigued by the idea of crafting courses that would teach ecology to people that were not scientists necessarily, but needed to understand science in order to do their jobs.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be a wonderful place because I was able to pursue my interest in conservation, preservation, environmental issues very freely, as well as create courses that would be very integrative because we'd talk about literature and science and art and all the things I had loved earlier and still allow me to pursue my interest in science.
Yeah.
So it turned into 20X years. Career. This all happened. I started here in 1975 in landscape architecture. And I was the only woman in the department and one of few women in the college. And
right.
of course, therein hangs another tale.
Yeah.
But are there some other things you want to know about the early years, as we might call them?
The early years. I think actually that's been good. So you were at the University of Wisconsin during the protest years.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yes, I remember seeing that.
And based on what you said earlier, about sort of the anti-nuclear war, I can imagine which side of the line you fell on. But would you be willing to
It was a very interesting time, and one which I will never forget, I guess is the best way to say it. At Carleton, the Vietnam War was not much in our headlights at that point. Even the men were not noticeably worried about the draft until my senior year, in which case I had several men friends who were very worried about graduating and being subject to the Vietnam War draft. And they handled it in a lot of different ways, including one friend of mine who went to Canada, and others who kind of decided that's why they went to grad school, and others who actually were drafted and had to serve, although those folks I didn't know quite as well as the other two who did what I mentioned. And at the time I came to Madison in 1970, it was at the time when a lot of the Vietnam War protests were heating up.
Yeah.
And I remember several things about that time, and it's these are kind of random thoughts, so I don't know how organized any of this is going to be, but obviously I was on the side of very much anti-war. I was very upset about some of the events that happened during those years, including bombings and also just the news reports that we would get. And yet I was very shy, so I was not one of the more vocal outspoken protesters. I was more likely to be one who would be joining a march with a candle, but not necessarily leading the charge at that point. I've changed. Now I'm more likely to be one of the vocal people, but I wasn't so much then. But there were a lot of things we were anguishing over. And in just on the teaching side, the Vietnam War protests got mixed in with the TAA formation and other social movements of the time, so that I was here during the first TA strike, during which TAs refused to hold classes. And that was extremely hard for me because I felt I had a duty to these students. I didn't think of teaching as a job. I thought of it as my calling. And it was a terrible thing for me to try to think about, now do I not hold classes in order to be in solidarity with the grad students who really have legitimate concerns, and therefore neglect the students who also were caught up in the Vietnam issue and needed to worry about their status? Or do I go ahead and hold classes and feel like I'm a traitor to the TAs? And I did hold classes, and it was partly because in the botany department, most of the TAs held classes. So it was not, I was not having to be standing up as a, you know, unique person. Again, I'm sure because of the shyness part. But it was a very difficult time because, of course, there were many students who wouldn't come to class under those conditions. And so we arranged alternative ways for them to complete their work and didn't penalize them for those kinds of things. So in my mind, the TA strike looms in some ways as large as the Vietnam War, although they're very different.
Yeah.
And I remember, because our offices were in Burge Hall, looking out the window of the third floor of Burge Hall and seeing troops lining the Bascom Hill. And I was tear gassed several times, in including one where I was at that time living in one of the dorms. In those days, the grad students could occupy the top floors of Whitty Hall, unmarried grad students. And so for the first year I was here, I was in one of those rooms, and we were gassed by the tear gas going up the elevator shafts, and experienced that close hand, plus the riots in the streets down below. Yeah. And it was a very scary time, because what angered me most, I think, were two things. One was the violence that the police displayed towards the students. And so I remember watching the War at Home in recent times and seeing certain police people on the screen, and what comes to my mind is the phrase, "you pigs," you know, just like we would have shouted back in those days. But the other was tendency of people mixing up all kinds of things that they were protesting all into one big bundle, so that you couldn't just be against the war. You had to be for this and for that and against this. And it got all fuzzy, so that it was no longer, to me, logical protesting. And it turned into just a untamed mob riot rather than what I viewed as a reasoned response against the war.
Yeah.
And so it was a very tumultuous time. And it was, and I remember the bombing of Sterling Hall, because I was in Madison at that time, just before things were starting for me, and felt the ground shake, not knowing what it was at that time. And a colleague of mine had his experiments really ruined because they were in the greenhouse in Birch Hall. And of course, that's nothing compared to the loss of life that happened during that time. But it was just a very difficult time socially, and one where I was very torn apart, because my mind was on one thing, but I hated the violence, and I was still too timid to really be vocal.
Yeah.
So that's what it was like. And I remember worrying about everything from giving poor grades for fear that people would be drafted and killed in Vietnam, to worrying about who was going in their place. If they weren't going, what about the poor people in the inner city who were having to go because they had no way out? And worrying about the damage that was done to the people who were in Vietnam. One of my roommates had a boyfriend at the time who was a translator in Vietnam, and he came back after his tour of duty and was never the same. He was basically shell-shocked and unable to function. And it was just a very difficult time.
So,
and now, of course, we're involved in another, whatever this action is that we're in Iraq. And, you know, for those of us who remember those times, and I'm a female, never having been having to go over there, never losing anyone particularly close to me, it still was a very disruptive time.
Yeah.
And hard to be a part of the campus, but also, on the other hand, very glad I was here.
Okay, so then I guess back to more
women in science.
Science things. What you had said before that you feel, did you say that you felt like you got offered the tenure track job rather than the 1 year position sort of because you're a woman and they were interested in bringing more women into the fold?
Yes, that would be my take on it. And even at the time, I thought that this is probably what was happening. And I'm saying that because it seems to me unusual to have a position out there that's really meant for 1 year that would have made sense that it was a one-year position because they would be trying to see if this experiment of bringing people into the department who were not landscape architects and have them join the faculty, that is kind of a radical idea. In fact, I don't know of too many places on campus at that time and even now where they would bring someone with a completely no background in the discipline at all and ask them to join the faculty for a purpose like they were describing. It sounded much more like would make sense for a one-year lecturer position than for someone who would become a permanent member of the faculty. And so that's why I say what I say.
Yeah.
Now, arguing against that, they had hired the year before someone with a PhD in geography to teach social aspects, but that person also had a design background.
Okay.
So that, to me, there's a difference there, yeah.
Yeah.
And subsequent to my being hired, they did hire someone else who had no background in landscape architecture, in this case a male. So I could be wrong, but I do know that the original position was for 1 year, and they extended it. And I thought, looking at the fact that there were no women in this faculty, let alone very few in the college, the main place where women were around at the time, this would have been in the middle 70s, would have been in what was then home economics.
Right.
And I think it may have still been attached to our college then, but in any event, that was about it. And that situation remained for quite a while in our college, and we can talk more about my experience there too in a bit perhaps. But it was interesting coming in here because my first experience was having to advise a whole lot of undergraduates on what courses they should take.
Right.
And landscape architecture as a curriculum is quite proscribed because there are a lot of studios that you need to take, and theoretically you should take Studio A before Studio B. And I came here knowing almost nothing about the curriculum, and suddenly I was faced with many undergrad advisees. They kind of foisted them off on me, and it was quite the learning experience, let's put it that way.
Yes, crash course.
Yeah. And I was hired in Sheridan office with another faculty member who was a landscape architect hired at the same time to teach design. And it was up in a balcony that overlooked the main studios. That's where all of the faculty had offices, so it wasn't like I was put in some weird corner.
Yeah.
But it was quite interesting to share an office, and it was helpful in some ways and not good in others, because it was helpful because I had someone there I could talk with about things. Although he was a junior faculty and in some ways as clueless as I was. It was difficult because if both of us had office hours at the same time, as you may remember from being a TA, it's sometimes very difficult to carry on a conversation in a confined space when there's not that, where we're talking about two different things. But that was just the way it was. I always say this like I'm an old fogey saying, in my day, you know, I shared an office and I was a noisy place, and now you're complaining because you have a little office rather than a big one.
I don't even have an office.
I know, yeah.
But yeah.
So it seems funny. I suppose it's true for every generation. Everyone always had different experience.
And now you said that also about a third of the people who were in your sort of graduate class were women. Did they go on to find jobs? What happened with them?
With them? A couple of them married and had families. Some of them married and professionals and went on to basically professional kinds of careers. But that was the rare situation. It was more they dropped it out of academia, essentially, in my particular class level. Now, people just a bit younger than I am, that was not quite so much the case. Many of them found positions in academia or in industry.
Mm-hmm.
So they landed on their feet somewhere. But anyway, but the men, most of them went on to careers in academia. So I would say it would be more likely in my era that the men would have gone on than the women would have.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how would you describe sort of the climate of the botany department when you were here towards women?
Well, it was an interesting situation because I never felt particularly singled out or discriminated against or expected least of or anything.
Mm-hmm.
I felt very much treated like a professional and a budding professional and a student and expected to excel and expected to go on and do all those things. So from that standpoint, I was very comfortable there. Some of the faculty members had difficulty knowing how to interact with women, and they had their own different styles of doing it. Grant Cottom used to talk sports with me all the time. I think he thought that was a safe subject. And he had a kind of a curmudgeonly reputation. But by the time I was there, he must have been in his 50s, and he was not so curt and sarcastic and biting toward any students, and certainly was never to me. So I got along quite well with him, I felt. But in general, just as I had said earlier about the reluctance to hire women faculty, I think that was definitely still there. They looked upon women in their own mix as being suspect and as not being quite able to compete academically. It was sort of interesting to me because, on the other hand, they would be pushing us as grad students to go out and get jobs.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting dichotomy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I have to say I felt always treated just like the men were.
Were there sort of particular faculty members who had a reputation as being sort of especially good and supportive of women or particularly nasty and difficult?
Not that I know. Not that I remember.
Okay.
Yeah. No, at least in my view, that what was more likely is that there were faculty who would tend to be more professional and those who would want to be buddies.
Right.
It was more along those lines than any feeling of being receptive or not towards women students.
Yeah.
And there were the rumors of the young faculty who would be hitting on women grad students.
Right.
And those kinds of things, I think, did happen.
Yeah.
But the only thing I could say at all that was uncomfortable, and in a way, looking back on it, it probably was just an interesting cultural change. Grant Cottom used to have in some of his lectures pictures of bathing beauties that he'd sort of slip in the middle of a lecture. And I think he would do it in order to get people's attention. They were not particularly provocative poses or anything like that. But a female grad student and I basically liberated one of those slides. And that was our message, and that ended it.
Interesting.
So no longer were they showing those kinds of pictures. So that was the most uncomfortable I was with those kinds of things. Otherwise, I didn't feel that way.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
So it was a good climate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then do you know of sort of any of, did any of the following forms of discrimination against women exist at UW at this time?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it lists things like hiring, promotion, salaries, workload, access to funding, teaching or service expectations, opportunities for leadership, honors or awards, sexual harassment, I mean, stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I became aware of those more when I became a faculty member than as a grad student.
Okay.
And so let me talk about my early years as a faculty member rather than as a grad student.
Yeah.
And I felt that I had not been given a lot of counsel in terms of what to bargain for in accepting a faculty position. So now whether this was just the times or because I was a female, I cannot tell you that. But I was hired with a 9-month salary, whereas most of the faculty in the department had 12-month salaries.
Okay.
And I had no what would now be called startup money.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't know whether this was, because I was so naive about this, I didn't ask the people who were hired at the same time I was what their deals were.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't make any of those kinds of bargaining arrangements. I think partly it was because of the switch from the one-year appointment to the tenure-track appointment. It
right.
just didn't register with me at all, nor had anyone counseled me that when you apply for a job, you should be asking X, Y, and Z question.
Yeah.
So I came here with none of that to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a handicap for me getting a research program started because I had nothing
yeah.
to start with. And so I felt that I started kind of 2 steps backwards that way.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the problem I have is not knowing because I was so naive of what other people were facing at the same time. And there were no other women to compare notes with, and I didn't
mm-hmm.
Ask the colleagues. So the other man who was hired when I was, to be fair, also was on a 9-month appointment. So
mm-hmm.
we were both hired in the same way. Subsequently, however, I fought for a 12-month appointment because I thought everyone else is on a 12-month appointment and why shouldn't I be? So they did,
yeah.
After I was here 3 years, I think it was, do that. What I found difficult was because I was one of the very few women in this whole college, is I was expected to do all kinds of things, including serve on innumerable committees,
mm-hmm.
Meaning by this university committees or college committees, not student committees.
Okay.
So they were trying to basically diversify, which is to their credit, but there's only so many things that one person can do. And looking back, it probably was a wonderful thing to happen to me because I got to know so many people in this college just by virtue of being on a gazillion committees. And I'm not exaggerating by the term gazillion. I think that if there was a committee, I was on it. Because there was like me and maybe one other female who probably had the same problem.
Yeah.
But of course, it did mean that I was not spending time on other things because I had to be in all these
yeah.
committees. And that was has been kind of a drawback all along for me. And I also felt that I did not get a lot of mentorship, which it now happens. And
mm-hmm.
again, I'm not sure whether this was naivete on part of my colleagues, on my part, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
I was kind of out there by myself doing what I could. Now, the thing that was helpful, too, for me, because this is my university that I was a grad student at, I also had known quite a few people going in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I talked to the folks in the botany department, and they gave me a fair amount of help in terms of what they thought would be a good area to do research in. And I could go talk to them about the concerns I was having, and they'd give me strategies to try to deal with my colleagues over here in landscape architecture. And so I was having an interesting learning curve because I had to learn landscape architecture in
mm-hmm.
addition to continuing with my ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was that was a great learning curve my first several years here because I had to learn what it was about landscape architecture that made them different in their reception of ecological ideas. So it was really kind of very nice that way. And I co-taught quite a few courses with Daryl Morrison, who was a landscape architect interested in biology.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very big, helpful colleague. He really was very generous with his time and so on. Now, I had some colleagues that really made me angry because they would expect things of me that I just didn't have the time to offer, but let me back up a little bit and say that one of the things that was difficult when I started as a faculty member is most faculty members were supported by a family and a wife who didn't work.
Right.
And so was able to take care of a lot of the other incidental functions in a person's life. And I never forget, it for some reason sticks in my mind, a discussion about a party that the department was going to plan. And one of the colleagues said, well, that's fine. I'll have my wife make X amount of this and X amount of that. And they were all going around the table, okay, fine. We'll contribute this, we'll contribute that. And then it comes to me and I'm saying, well, I have no time to, yeah, you know, to bake a gazillion cookies or do all of these other things. And I felt uncomfortable having to make a statement like that because I didn't have a wife behind me,
yeah,
to basically do all of these functions. And so the way that the expectation was at those times is that if you were a faculty member, all you had to worry about was your academic job, and the rest of life's trials and tribulations were taken care of by your spouse. Mm-hmm. And that includes supporting things, functions that are going on, mm-hmm, at the university too. And so that was hard for me to deal with. And it's different now. That has changed. People now recognize that there are responsibilities for home life no matter what sex you are.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot is much better now. In terms of actual discrimination, it's difficult for me to know whether I was ever overlooked because I was a female or, mm-hmm, things of that sort. But I do know that I would get the jobs that are typically female-like. In other words, counseling students or, mm-hmm, planning social events or things of that sort, as compared to sitting on the research committee or doing things of that sort. And early on in our career here, myself and other junior faculty felt very much that the senior faculty, most of whom are no longer here, essentially said, once they hired a bunch of junior faculty, okay, now we senior faculty can do what we want to do. We want to do research, and we don't want to teach anymore, so we're going to have all the teaching done by the junior faculty. And I really felt that was the case.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's female discrimination, but it was certainly very difficult, and we've tried to change that too.
Yeah.
It was kind of a rebellion I had to have against the senior senior faculty. Yeah. So that's my experience. So I, in a way, it was kind of fuzzy,
yeah,
in terms of overt discrimination. Mm-hmm. But I will say that it was much better. It's much nicer now to have other women, almost, I don't know what percentage it would be increased now, because I think women see things differently. We have a different take on things. We're more cooperative rather than confrontational. We try to solve problems rather than win or lose, and I see that happening in a lot of things now,
mm-hmm,
that was not true when I started. It was all couched in right and wrong, win and lose, power politics, and it's different now.
Yeah. Did you see, so in 1972, there were, mm-hmm, two key pieces of legislation, mm-hmm, the Equal Opportunity Act and the Educational Amendments, mm-hmm, Act. So did people discuss that, or, I mean, was that a part of the community here? Did it have any effect?
Right. I don't, the reason I would say yes is because of the hunch I had right from the beginning that I was hired as part of affirmative action.
Yeah.
So I think, was in my mind at that time, and certainly early on, mm-hmm, when I was a member of the faculty. And I looked upon it as a really good thing because it gave me this wonderful opportunity to do what I want to do.
Yeah.
And I don't think it would have happened without it. I really don't think they would have felt that they had to offer, that here was a way to get more women in the faculty.
Yeah.
Had it not been for that legislation. So, yes, I would say that had been talked about. Now, I don't think the department talked about it so much.
Yeah.
But I certainly did among my friends and also even among botany people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And were you involved in any organizations for women on campus?
No, I never did that. There was at one time, and I can't even remember the name of the group, but it was a women in science group, mm-hmm, where some faculty from other places on campus, senior faculty, would get together with grad students, and it's like having a coffee clutch periodically.
Yeah.
And I would attend those, but I was not particularly active in that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And were there, please talk about any other people who were prominent advocates for women interests on campus. Do you remember, mm-hmm, sort of?
Not much. I don't, mm-hmm, remember a lot,
mm-hmm,
there. What I would do in was find other women essentially that were faculty or I had a very good colleague, Virginia Klein, who was a grad student undergrad Cottam, who came a little bit after I did, who actually was a mature student when she started and became the arboretum ecologist. And she and I would get together all the time and have a support group about things that were going on in our lives. And she had a harder time than I did working at the Arboretum ultimately because of some discrimination that happened mm-hmm. with her that we would talk quite a bit about and get upset about. And we were joined periodically by a person who was at the botany department's faculty, Linda Graham, who is now a really eminent biologist, botanist. And we would get together and have lunch and talk about the things that were affecting our lives at that point. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of thing we did. I just don't remember thinking in those terms particularly. I do know later on, maybe a decade or 15 years ago now, being very concerned over some women faculty in the sciences in our college who were having a very...
Okay, so
I was just reflecting that I do remember participating with folks having to do with equity, salary adjustments and so on that had to do with other colleagues of mine in this college who I think really had a rougher road to hoe than I did. My frustration on this campus is kind of compounded by the fact that I'm an ecologist in an odd department. Landscape architecture is odd in a lot of ways. It's a humanities department in this college, which is mostly science.
Yeah.
And I'm still a member of the biology faculty, so I'm odd in that sense. And as an ecologist, it's not one of the prominent sciences on campus. The sciences have been, ever since I've been here, heavily loaded towards either physics, chemistry, and or molecular biology or whatever term people are now using for those areas. And so I have always felt difficulties more from that than I have from being a female in terms of exerting power and concern over lack of faculty hires and resources going away from things like the herbarium and into molecular biology labs and those kinds of issues have been very difficult for me. And my experience in this department is that we have been at times on the brink of being cut from the university when budget crises have happened because we're viewed as being non-essential in that we have a very different way of looking at the world.
Right.
And I'm also in a college which had prominent researchers advocating herbicides when I was a big opponent of using chemicals. And so I find myself on that end of things more, almost more than worrying about my gender.
Yeah.
And it got more involved that way than others. Whereas some of my colleagues in the more traditional hard sciences like genetics and biochemistry and other places had, I think, a more difficult time based on gender. Than I did, because it gets so conflated.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I could hide over here because I'm doing an atypical kind of science and I'm not a threat to the other scientists, if you see what I mean. Because I've known of colleagues who began here and were very much helped by their senior colleagues until they themselves became senior or got tenure, in which case they began to be looked at as competitors and consequently felt... discrimination.
Okay.
Whereas that didn't happen to me because I was unique.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how would you say that sort of campus climate has changed over the last,
at times I've been here?
Yeah.
Well, a couple things have happened. We're much more diverse now, so it's no longer unusual to have women as colleagues and as leaders. When I first was here, that was very unusual. And sometimes you'd be mistaken for the secretary. And I did experience situations where I would make a point in a meeting and people would ignore it. And then a man would make the same point and people would then agree to it. And that happened to me many times. And it no longer happens that way. It's either because I'm getting older or because there are so many more women that people are not surprised to have women speak up. I also think that the expectations of faculty members, on the one hand, are getting more difficult, and on the other hand, people recognize that faculty also have other lives to lead. So I guess mm-hmm. what I'm saying is that I think in some ways it's harder to fit in all the activities we're supposed to do. But at the same time, people realize that it's okay to take the afternoon off because your kid has a concert, or because mm-hmm. you have to pick your kid up, whether you're a male or a female, from daycare. And that's a lot more understanding. I think yeah. there have been some very good innovations with regard to childcare and adoption and birth, you know, parental leave and things of that sort that didn't exist when I first came. And made a lot easier for people to have family lives. And as you know, I'm not married, and mm-hmm. at the time that that would have been happening, I made a choice, basically, to not pursue that part of my life because mm-hmm. I didn't think I could do it.
Yeah.
Do both things. And I, you know, of course I regret it, but it was a choice I made. Mm-hmm. And now I don't think women are faced with the same
yeah.
situation, which I'm very glad of. Yeah, so it isn't a choice between a family and a career. It's now possible to do both things without being super women, which yeah. is the other thing that would have happened in mm-hmm. the era that I was in. You had to be a superwoman to do both. And it doesn't work that way now. Thank goodness. Yeah. It's much better. So I think it's changed that way too, and I'm... Still, however, in our college, there are now, I think there will be two women chairs in the college. We have some 20-some departments, and this is my second stint as being department chair. I was a stint once before, about a decade ago, and at that time, there had been one woman chair in the history of the college, setting aside home economics, mm-hmm. and I was the second one. And
wow.
There still now are only two women chairs. And so we seem to have a glass ceiling of some sort where people don't get into those positions. Yeah. They either leave before getting that far or, you know, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I can't comment on other departments.
Yeah.
In that way.
Okay. And so is it all right if we switch topics?
Sure.
I'm very curious about teaching. So mm-hmm. you have said already that teaching is really important to you and
yes.
has been sort of since you were first
yep.
given your TA-ship.
My TA-ship, absolutely.
And I know that, so you also now teach in the BioCorp program
mm-hmm.
that doesn't count towards the teaching requirement here.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So how did you develop this strong commitment to teaching?
Well, I think it's just part of my soul. And literally,
yeah.
I find it to be fascinating to puzzle through how to explain something to someone in
mm-hmm.
a way that they can understand it. And I think from my environmentalist bent, it's like a mission to me to get people to realize the importance of ecological interactions, whatever
mm-hmm.
they make a decision to do with their lives. Because it's so fundamental to our life support system. And so in a way, I view education as one way I can contribute to the next generation and make life better for all of us. As a person in a faculty, you could do this in a lot of different ways, including research, which really helps inform our knowledge and helps us better understand how the world works. And another way is by translating that information so that other people can understand it and incorporate it into their worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that latter part that I find the most challenging and most interesting,
yeah.
even more than the discovery process itself. So, and I find very interesting because I learn so much from the students. It helps me understand
mm-hmm.
the topic better to see how they are processing it, and never fails to have students ask a question that makes me look at something differently, or that they have a response in an exam or otherwise that makes me say, oh yeah, that's right, they could do it that way.
Yeah.
And so that's why I find teaching just absolutely endlessly fascinating. It's never boring, it's never the same, because it's always different people.
Mm-hmm.
It's often very frustrating. I still get extremely frustrated with myself because I can't seem to get a point across, or don't seem to understand what the barrier is and so on. And I find it, the more I think about it, the more interesting how different styles humans have to understand things. Yeah. The difference between visual learners and, you know, just simplistically visual learners versus oral learners versus people who have to write it out for themselves and put it in their own words and people who do it mathematically or symbolically. And it's just really interesting for me to see that and try to figure out how I can respond to each of these different ways of people's light bulbs going on. Yeah. So that's really why. And partly it's like a mission that I have to for people to understand the interrelationship of all things. And partly that from another selfish reason, it's just so interesting to try it, to see how they work. Mm-hmm. So it's always been very important to me.
Yeah. And have you used field work in your classes?
Oh, all the time. Field work is one of the big parts of my teaching in landscape architecture and would be in BioCore if I could do the lab too, darn it. But I have my hands in on the lab part too, because I think that type of discovery is just very crucial in any reinforcement of learning. Excuse me for a minute.
We were at teaching and fieldwork.
Oh yeah, fieldwork. And the way I look at teaching is that it's got to be an active process that students have to be engaged in. And in a lot of cases, the best way people learn is by applying information or discovering it for themselves. And in ecology, I don't see how you can do ecology if you don't go in the field.
Yeah.
And so field work is absolutely essential. Field trips, seeing plants and animals actually out there, trying to understand what's going on, not in a theoretical setting, but in a real world setting, is really important.
And how did you come to this sort of teaching philosophy?
By teaching, actually. When I started out teaching, as we talked about, I was a TA, and we were in a traditional classroom setting for a lot of the time, and partly because of the way the weather works in Wisconsin. But it began to dawn on me when we had the chance to take field trips that the students were engaged in a little bit different way than they were in the lab, in that I would see a lot more independent observations and light bulbs going on than I was able to see in some of the laboratory situations. And then coming into landscape architecture department, we had a class called, which we still teach, called Field Study Native Plant Communities, which is a 3-week period where we do nothing but go into the field. And it really reinforced for me how important that way of interacting with environmental ecosystems is for people, because I could see a lot faster grasping of concepts. I could see people really visualizing some of the things we talked about in class. And I think that really reinforced it. And so now I think of teaching as has to be kind of a combination of observational field trips as well as manipulative experiments where they're trying to collect data and look at all the messiness of the real world. And so that's what did it. It was actually seeing people out there and behaving differently and becoming engaged and having different kinds of insights and I think more reinforcing than what happened in lab.
Did you, as part of your graduate work, was there sort of field work that went along with that as well?
Yes, we had both classes, and of course, research was field work. But there were classes where we did ecological methods, where we went out every week collecting data in the same area, and also had trips that related to the different ecology classes. So it's even in back in college, all the ecology classes had a field component. Because I think in part when I took the classes, they were taught by people who came to ecology from an interest in the natural world rather than from an interest in other things, like in mathematics or other areas. And I think that's the reason why I'm kind of falling in that same set of footsteps. But I don't see myself how you can be a real ecologist if you don't know something about the organisms. So I'm falling on that side of the debate between ecology and ecology. Because I know there are good ecologists who come at it much more from a a systems perspective or a mathematical right. perspective.
But, which certainly, given your background,
yep,
was a possible route. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, and I still like that, but
yeah,
and it still intrigues me, but I'm kind of falling into the side of the field work.
Yeah.
Partly because it works so well with students.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting questions. Interesting questions to get me to actually think about where I'm from and why I'm doing what I'm doing. Yeah.
And so then, describe what you think is one of the most sort of important interactions that you've had with a student or with a class. Like, what is there something that sticks out in your mind as being particularly, yes, it was really working that day?
Gosh, that's so difficult because I'm sure there have been many such times, and so I may have to think about recent ones rather than long-term ones. There have been a couple of classes I've taught in landscape architecture where we do restoration plans, which means mm-hmm. that we're taking a site that exists in the real world, and often a property from the Nature Conservancy or from private ownership in some cases from the Arboretum, and making recommendations for the restoration of it to natural systems. And there have been a couple of cases where we've had students really get very interesting ideas about how to do that restoration, and it's gotten moved into the mainstream and actually happened. And so I remember one maybe 15, 20 years ago at the Arboretum, which is now the Wingra Oak Savannah, mm-hmm. working with Virginia Klein and getting a class of students to come up with a radical idea of cutting down a lot of trees, opening it up, and creating a savannah. And what was so intriguing about that is it actually happened. And the students saw it happen. And it was very gratifying from that standpoint, which is not exactly a intellectually learning experience that the students suddenly had, but it was more the idea that what they did actually could make a difference in the world. And now they come back and they see the savannah, and they're just very pleased that what they were able to learn and promote actually worked for them in that. And I remember several situations in a class called Site Inventory and Analysis, working with students to understand interrelationships in the water cycle and seeing it actually click in their minds that stormwater events are connected with paving surfaces. And I remember situations where suddenly it dawned on them, oh my gosh, that means if I build another house, it's going to cause this much more cubic feet of water running into the lake, which will cause this kind of a flood. And it was like suddenly a systems link went off in this group of students' minds. And they had been struggling with it for several days and weeks. And it was like one of those aha experiences that was so gratifying to actually see it click in their heads that way. And in BioCore, I've had similar experiences working one-on-one with students where we were talking about a topic like population growth, and suddenly the light goes on and they begin to see the consequences, and it's like suddenly everything makes sense and down the road it goes clicking.
Yeah.
So I've had a lot of those kinds of experiences with individual students. Yeah. So I don't know if that answers the question exactly.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And that my most ongoing controversy has to do with relocating a road. That was another suggestion coming up from one of our classes in restoration ecology down in the west end of campus near the class of 1918 Marsh. And the students did some research and discovered that, kind of to make a long story short, two things. One, that there used to be a creek, which is now a ditch, a channelized creek, that used to meander. And so they came up with a plan to put the meander back and thereby restore some of the functions of the wetlands in the University Bay. And of course, that has been completely turned down by the powers that be because it would be too expensive to do. Mm-hmm. And then we also want to relocate the road that now separates the class of 1918 Marsh from the University Bay to go around the other side of the marsh, which would make sense in almost any way you think of it. But nobody has bought into it yet. So that's one of the things I'm keeping hammering on.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like quite a number of the class projects that you've been involved with have had sort of a direct impact on the university campus.
Yep, one way or another, and or potentially could have direct impact.
Yeah.
And the thing that I find gratifying in some ways is that some of the folks who now have a lot of authority were some of my students, like Gary Brown, who's high up in the campus planning, was a student of mine. And so I have my hope that one of these days he will convince other people up there.
Cool. Yeah. So when you started in landscape architecture, how much was the research emphasized? You said you felt like you started a little bit behind because, you didn't have the startup money.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right.
How?
Well, I actually got tenure on the basis of excellence in teaching. So, excuse me.
Let's see. We were at landscape architecture being hired. You got tenure on the basis of teaching.
Yeah, I was hired, and here in this college, they give you percentages about teaching, research, etc. And I'm on an 80% teaching and 20% research appointment.
Okay.
Which means that theoretically, they're looking at me more from the standpoint of what I do in teaching than what I do in research.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, in getting tenure, you still have to demonstrate that you're capable of doing research.
Yeah.
So I still had to demonstrate that at the time I got tenure, which would have been back in 81, I think it was, when I got tenure. So that was a problem because my teaching has never been difficult in the sense I've always gotten good reviews. I've always done a fairly good job, both by the student's perspective and the faculty's perspective. So, and plus I had done a lot of different things that were innovative because I was coming in as an ecologist teaching in a different department. So I was able to demonstrate how I was adapting ecology to this area. And this was before I was in BioCorps, so I didn't even have a straight science course to deal with. So I was doing a lot of different things trying to bring in that perspective. And just to back up a little bit, our students do have to take a regular ecology class. So they usually take Botany Zoo 460 or 260, so a fairly traditional ecology class. Plus, they have to have basic intro biology. So it's not like I have to teach them basic materials. But the problem that the department felt at the time I was hired is that the students were not able to connect concepts like the energy cycle with decisions they were making on the land in terms of how they made design choices, or water cycle and how they made design choices. So they wanted someone to come in who was an ecologist who could try to translate those concepts more specifically to the design problems the students were working with.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the kind of thing I did in terms of teaching. But for research, I basically was influenced by two things, one of which was Daryl Morrison, who was interested in natural landscaping, which means using native species in the built environment. So he was looking at ecosystems and how could we plant prairie plants in an urban area. And also my experience with Grant Cottom and others who had been influential with the Arboretum. And I got intrigued by how do we, what is now called, restore prairies and woodlands. So I began in kind of the pioneering era of restoration ecology, looking for ways of planting prairies, planting woodlands, and so on. So that fit really well both in landscape architecture because of this connection with natural landscape design, and also in my conservation mission to try to keep protecting plants and animals of the state of Wisconsin. So I was able to eventually hit upon a series of projects which dealt with both understanding impact and doing site selections in a better way than landscape architects had done them before, and also basic experiments in restoration ecology using fire and also just planting techniques. So it took me about 3 years to get that off the ground, both in terms of funding and also in terms of just finding my way to something that would work with this department's mission, as well as what the biological sciences division would look upon as acceptable.
Yeah.
And so when my tenure package was put together, it was heavy on the teaching end of things and not so much on the research, which is unusual still today, as I understand it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so how did you fund your research?
Well, I had what's called a Hatch grant, which is something that the College of Ag and Life Sciences gets through the federal government,
mm-hmm.
Pots of money, not that much, but money, that is supposed to help the citizens of the state, especially in agricultural kind or natural resource management kinds mm-hmm. of things. And so I wrote a Hatch grant and received funding for it. I also got funding through the grad school for a project that Virginia Klein and I did on mm-hmm. The Arboretum. And I also got funding from the Fish and Wildlife Service on a restoration project. So I essentially was able to get some grant money.
Yeah, patching it together a little bit here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, if I were being hired now, I would be looking for startup money that would enable me to do that. And
yeah.
The thing about the kind of work I did is that I don't need a lot of expensive equipment, but I do need access to labs, access to computers now, and mm-hmm. access to people, to field workers, mm-hmm. to collect the data. And yeah. that's what the money still has to go to. Yeah. So yeah. now I have a grant from the National Park Service to do work at Effigy Mounds National Monument, for example. And then other little pots of money that help fund some things on the campus natural areas.
Yeah.
But still, I'm doing 80% teaching, so.
Yeah. Wow. So taking on more mm-hmm. above and beyond 80% yeah. is really, that's.
Yep. A lot of teaching. But I do enjoy it, so.
Yeah.
That's the good news.
Yes.
But I do find myself, now I'm department chair, so I find myself like no time to do anything other yeah. than very superficial patching together of things. So I regret, because I don't get to do as much innovation right now
yeah.
in the teaching. And well, you remember BioCorps, and every year I try to do a different spin on a lecture.
Yeah.
But it's harder to do those spins now because I don't have as much time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well.
And what do you think are the most significant changes that have taken place in landscape architecture since you've been here?
Well, I think when I began, the typical project would be something like, you have 300 acres of land and the developer wants you to put 350 housing units on it. How would you do it? And the students would take that at face value and cram in the 350 units of housing. Okay. Now, the first thing the students are asking is, can this site actually support housing? Is it
okay.
economically, ecologically, mm-hmm. both the right thing to do?
Mm-hmm.
And so they begin with that premise rather than, okay, they're telling me to do this, I'll do it.
Yeah.
So I really see a change in the way in which we approach projects, because we're now questioning right from the beginning, is this desire of a client really the thing that ought to happen on this land?
Mm-hmm.
And whether this gets translated when they graduate into people literally saying, I'm sorry, I won't accept your money to do this, I cannot
yeah.
feel so sanguine about. But this department clearly has changed in terms of the first kinds of questions that are asked, and just the expectation that students have to know the environmental consequences of their activities
mm-hmm.
and be conversant with native species and with those kinds of issues, preservation mm-hmm. issues, and also with ecological cycles, they understand much better than they did earlier.
Mm-hmm.
The consequences and just the theory that backs up some of the decisions that are made. So I see that to be very different from when I started,
yeah.
which I'm very happy about. It's
yeah.
now part of their vocabulary,
Ooh.
Whereas before it wasn't. However, I can't, you know, I'm still not reaching everybody. And
yeah.
I think when they go their own way when they're done, but what can you do?
Yeah. Although mm-hmm. my understanding is that landscape architecture firms have definitely changed
yes.
as well.
Yes.
And so I know that there are places yes. for people to get jobs.
Definitely.
In different kinds of.
No, that's definitely true.
That
that's definitely
to,
true.
So.
And I have to say, too, that our department is now more than 50% women.
Excellent.
Which is not the way it was, as you know, when I came.
Yeah.
And there are many more women even now in the college, although not as many as there ought to be.
Yeah.
I think we still have a ways to go. And there are more women in the botany department, for sure. And
mm-hmm.
so I'm very happy about what I see as changes there.
Yeah.
So apparently those of us who were kind of pioneers in my era didn't ruin it completely for everybody. Yeah.
Okay. Would you like to stop here for now?
What's the next set of things you want to ask?
It's a new section on sort of career at Madison and service.
Yeah, maybe we should stop. Okay. Yeah, because I think we've only got...